Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. John White, Chief Medical Officer at WebMD, and I want to welcome you all to this session at BIOS, which is called Redefining Biopharma in a Female-Forward World. These are the panelists that you're going to hear from in a few minutes, but first I want to go over what is the purpose of this panel discussion. And again, it's about a female-forward world. And when we think about that, the latest United Nations estimates show that men slightly outnumber women globally. However, as life expectancies increase, women will outnumber men at older ages, 55% of those ages, 65 years globally. And society will be facing an unprecedented health challenge. Hundreds of millions of women have diseases that need therapies and improved access over their lifetime. In recent analysis, found these challenges are driving the women's health market. Joining me today to discuss some of the specifics is a terrific panel that you're going to enjoy hearing from. Lynn Seely is the President and Chief Executive Officer of Myovant Sciences. Sabrina Johnson is the Chief Executive Officer of Dare Bioscience. Senya Aronicki is the Chief Executive Officer of Preglam SA. And last but not least is Patrick Jordan, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Mycovia Pharmaceuticals and partner NovaQuest Capital Management. Each of them are going to spend a few minutes telling about their companies, and we're going to start off with Dr. Seely.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here with all of you today. And for those of you who don't know much about Myovant Sciences, let me tell you that we are a company focused on redefining care for women and for men. We currently have three late-stage clinical programs. We're developing Relugolix combination tablet as a potential new medicine for women suffering from uterine fibroids and from endometriosis. We're also developing Relugolix as a one pill once a day for men with advanced prostate cancer. It is the first and only oral medicine to lower testosterone in these men, which is important because it's the key growth factor for prostate cancer. Next slide. Myovant Sciences is a young company. We were founded in 2016, and just months after that, in 2017, we launched five global phase three clinical studies, one in prostate cancer, two in women with uterine fibroids, two for women with endometriosis. And in 2018 and 19, we completed an enrollment of more than 3,000 study participants in these three trials. And then in 2019, began to announce positive data. We have announced positive results from our phase three prostate cancer, as well as from two phase three studies in women with uterine fibroids. Next slide. And you can see here in the first half of 2020, we have many milestones, and I'm proud to say we're continuing to execute despite this difficult COVID-19 pandemic. In March, we submitted our marketing authorization application to the European Medicines Agency for uterine fibroids. And we established a commercial partnership with Gedeon Richter in uterine fibroids and endometriosis for certain ex-US markets like Europe and Latin America. In April, we submitted our new drug application for prostate cancer and reported out positive results from our SPIRIT-2 phase three study in endometriosis, the first of two required studies. And then in May, we will submit our NDA for uterine fibroids, as well as present data in an oral presentation at the American Society of Clinical Oncology. And finally, before the end of June, we expect to provide top line results for our second required phase three trial in endometriosis. So as you can see, lots happening at Myovant Sciences.
And with that, we're going to turn it over to Sabrina.
Thank you. So I'm Sabrina Martucci-Johnson. I'm the CEO, one of the founders of Dare Bioscience. And we are focused solely and squarely on women's health. So I'm super excited about the panel discussion today and the topics we're going to cover. Next slide is our forward-looking statements. We are a publicly traded company. And so my comments are going to include some forward-looking statements. And then on the next slide, I wanted to spend a minute focused on what we are doing at DARE. So as I mentioned, we're focused solely and squarely on women's health, and specifically that's in four key therapeutic pillar areas. So vaginal health, sexual health, family planning, and fertility. And we have a number of programs that really span those therapeutic areas. And we pick our programs based on opportunities that address some of the most persistent unmet needs in women's health. And we're very focused on accelerating innovation, moving those innovative products forward. And we focus primarily on products that are first in category. And because of some of the unique attributes of women's health, we're able to do this often with products that actually can leverage a 505(b)(2) regulatory pathway and all the benefits that that pathway can provide in terms of time and expense to market, but still deliver on first-in-category opportunities. This year is an exciting year for us because we are planning on running our phase 3 trial in bacterial vaginosis, which is our latest stage program. We're actually have announced that in this COVID world, and despite some of the delays that others are experiencing because of this condition and the seriousness of it, women are still seeing their healthcare providers. And so we announced we're going to start that phase 3 in July. And we anticipate having data readout before the end of this year on that bacterial vaginosis program with a one-time vaginal product. And earlier this year, we announced our partnership with Bayer for our once-a-month hormone-free contraceptive Ovaprene that we had a positive data readout the end of last year. And on the heels of that, announced our commercial partnership with Bayer. And we're looking forward to commencing the phase 3 that's required for that program to support a data readout in 2022. And then the third program I'll highlight in the portfolio is our Sildenafil Cream program, which we are developing to address female sexual arousal disorder, which is her version of erectile dysfunction. This is a program that very beautifully leverages that 505(b)(2) regulatory pathway where we are taking Sildenafil, the known active ingredient in Viagra, and developing it in a cream form that is on demand, applied locally for women. And we expect to have a phase 2B data readout from that program in 2021. So the next 3 years are really exciting for us right now in terms of bacterial vaginosis program phase 3 this year. Sildenafil cream phase 2B should be reading out before the end of next year, and then Ovaprene with our partnership with Bayer reading out the following year. I'm not going to highlight the rest of the portfolio now for the interest of time, but they similarly were addressing similar persistent unmet needs across a variety of other therapeutic areas, including infertility and hormone replacement. And I look forward to the discussion today.
All right. And with that, we're going to move to Senya.
Thank you, John. Thank you for inviting me. I'm very excited to be part of the panel. So I'm the CEO of Preglem. I'm actually very happy to be part of the panel because we are no longer a startup company trying to advance their product portfolio, because we had, after doing so for quite a few years, we had a successful exit and we became a member of Get Enriched Group. So if you go to the next slide, we have now commercially available products. On the left hand, you have two innovative products that we brought in order to address really unmet need in women health. And one is Itesmia, that was a product that, let's say, changed quite significantly the way that uterine fibroids are treated, at least in Europe. And Benfola, which is another product that is trying to treat infertility, dedicated to women, but it's helping couples. So I think that some of the discussions today will be of relevance of what we are trying to do. As Gedon Richter is a commercial, well-established company, the way for the group to enlarge the portfolio and actually address many unmet needs is to do the alliances or to acquire companies like us. So Preglen became a member of Get Enriched Group. We were reacquired, but I'm very happy to be on the panel with my partners, Patrick Jordan, with whom we have Elias and Lynn. So, and maybe Sabrina one day with you as well. But I think it's very important to really see that the innovation happens in the hands of small startup companies that are really dedicating their time and effort to addressing unmet needs. And maybe that's the most efficient way for a bigger pharmaceutical company to actually access the innovation, at least in the field of women health. And that's where Get Enriched as a group, I think, is making smart moves.
And now I want to turn to my good friend, Patrick Jordan.
Thank you. Great pleasure to join this team today. Mycovia Pharmaceuticals is focused on women's health, and I'll give you a little more details about that on the next slide, please. So we were created a little more than 2 years ago through an acquisition that was made in Research Triangle Park. NovaQuest, where I'm a partner, purchased a company called Viamet Pharmaceuticals. We were very attracted to an oral antifungal therapy that was being used in two areas, one for a disease called recurrent vulvovaginal candidiasis, and the other for nail fungus, onychomycosis. And we put the RVVC indication really in a priority seat and started immediately in February with phase three studies that would evaluate oteseconazole globally with 11 countries throughout Europe, the US, and Japan. We were very happy in mid-year last year to announce our first partnership with the largest pharmaceutical company in China by market cap, Hengrui Medicine, to advance oteseconazole for RVVC and other indications. And we too began to formalize a linkage to Gedeon Richter, just like my friend Xenia and Lynn, in October. We announced a licensing arrangement with Gedeon Richter. It has a long heritage of women's health leadership for RVVC. Very happy to have completed in November recruitment for our phase three program and in December for our pivotal trials. And all of that put us in a very strong position for being able to submit for our NDA, which we expect in 2021. We are, in fact, though, still running a study, despite we have a 48-week program for our pivotal trials. We're evaluating oteseconazole for an additional 48 weeks, which is quite significant for women that have been suffering with multiple recurrences of these infections over their lifetime. Let's go to the next slide. So I've covered, we're quite advanced in our RVVC program. I'll give light treatment to the onychomycosis program only to say that there was really significant data that was produced through phase 2B. And puts 1161 or oteseconazole in a strong position as an alternative therapy for onychomycosis. And we also have our eye on other very difficult to treat fungal infections with VT1598, which is in a single ascending dose program with the NIH. And it's known to have activity against some very serious threats, Candida auris, Cryptococcus neoformans, which is quite endemic in Africa. And coccidioides, also known as valley fever. So we're focused today, though, on a topic that's so vital to all of our interest. And as I hand it back to John, I want to do so with a word of thanks. Thank you, John, for your leadership and willingness to be our moderator. You have distinguished yourself at WebMD as being a very wise and respected voice in healthcare. And I also want to thank my colleagues on the panel, Lynn, Sabrina, Xenia, you're an inspiration to work with, and I'm delighted to be able to work with you. Finally, Bio, thanks for the venue for this. We look forward to the conversation.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for those kind words. That doesn't mean I'm going to go easy on everyone. And now that we've laid out the field, I am going to say, since you mentioned WebMD, more women than men search for health online. Our audience skews towards more women. There's a bimodal distribution. Women early on looking for issues of fertility and weight loss. and fitness, and then older on in their 60s and 70s, relating to issues of overall health, cardiovascular, neurology, et cetera. So that comes to the point, it's a great title to talk about a female world, but I wanna ask each of you, is that just, you know, a pithy statement? How is biopharma female in terms of the future? And how do the demographics play into that? Let's start with Lynn.
Sure. Well, I think the future of biopharma is female for several reasons. We all know that women make up 50% of the population, so that's important. And there are many diseases which are exclusive to women. But in addition, there are diseases where women are overrepresented or disproportionately represented. And then, of course, there are diseases which present differently in women, all of which need attention. And I can tell you, diseases of women are very oftentimes underdiagnosed. And when they are diagnosed, the treatments that are available for them are oftentimes inadequate. So there's a tremendous and huge need to open up new treatments for women. And I think one of the interesting features about women's health issues is that they're really poorly understood. We think so much about educating the public about rare diseases, but in fact, there are millions of women suffering from diseases that nobody talks about. And so at Myovant Sciences, when we think about step number one for ensuring a female biopharma world in the future, it is really elevating the conversation. And so we have started a cross-sector coalition, which we call Female Forward Together, bringing various groups together who are all motivated to elevate this conversation and educate about women's health issues. And for example, we've partnered with healthywomen.org and The Moth to do a storytelling series where women can talk about period diseases that are embarrassing. The first one is available. It talks about a woman who kept her period secret from her mother for 2 years. We have partnered with Flow, which has 30 million users. It's the most commonly used period tracker. And turns out women don't know what's a normal amount of bleeding, what's too much bleeding, what's normal pain or too much pain. And so we've partnered with them to develop an app where women can track bleeding and have a tool to engage in conversation with their physicians about if they think they're bleeding or pain or too much. And then finally, for example, we've partnered with a health and measurement company known as Evidation to run a huge survey about menstrual health and perceptions about it, 30,000 respondents to really understand better about menstruation. So there's so many things that we can do together to educate and elevate this conversation, which will help ensure a female forward future for biopharma.
Sabrina, how does demographics play into this? 55%, 50%, 60%, does it really matter?
Yeah, demographics are certainly a factor, but I think one of the other factors that is definitely at play, and Lynn kind of touched on this, is that there are a number of obviously persistent unmet needs in women's health. And we are seeing more drug development initiatives focused on that. But I think part of that is because women's unique biology offers some innovative ways where we can actually enhance outcomes, enhance convenience, address some of these persistent unmet needs, not always by necessarily having to innovate the way we often think of in drug discovery, but instead looking at ways to deliver the products to women, truly drug delivery, delivering them to women in a way that makes sense for her and to address that condition. So whether it's vaginal drug delivery, whether it's longer term drug delivery, but really looking at delivering the products in a way that makes sense for her. So I think leverage that unique female body. We're certainly one of them, but we're starting to see that. And I think it's enhancing one of the reasons that there is a little more focus in this area. And one of the other reasons I know we'll talk about maybe a little bit later in the panel, which is really related to where drug development is happening for women's health products as well.
Sanya, do you believe the future is female in biopharma?
I for sure do. That's why I am in biopharma.
Touché.
Yeah. No, I think it's, I would only support, I can only stress and support what Lynn and Sabrina have said. I think there is a tremendous amount of diseases and conditions that are sometimes considered as taboos or are simply considered by heritage or genetical heritage. I mean, heavy periods as a woman, that's what you're born with and it's kind of you have to cope with, whereas it's not at all something that women take lightly, mm-hmm. and it has an impact on the quality of life, and the quality of life of a woman is not just something individually affecting only her. It affects her family, it affects her working environment, her children, her husband. So I would say that the future in biopharma is that has definitely a very big place for becoming more female, let's say.
And Mr. Jordan, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think the numbers would speak for it. In the U.S., women make 80% of the healthcare decisions in their homes, yet it's striking that they often go without healthcare themselves. And I think when we're talking with industry peers and our colleagues, that a lot of that is the result of just a lack of dialogue. I was encouraged to hear Lynn's experience with Healthy Women. I know that WebMD and Healthy Women had conducted a survey, and it showed that about half of women proactively discussed their healthcare concerns with their providers. But that means that half don't. And that's in the US, where there's more of an ability to engage with healthcare professionals. In other parts of the world, women are silenced even further for social norms and for other reasons. And in a great majority of these instances, those silencing results in worse healthcare outcomes. And if not that, then it's endemic poverty. So what do we do about it? And I think today is a really good example. And as I mentioned, I'm thrilled to be able to participate with my colleagues on this panel and for Bio. We're also hearing more positive stories from high profile women about their health. We know Angelina Jolie's conversation that she started globally about preventative surgeries when she removed her ovaries and had a double mastectomy. Olympic gold medalist Lindsey Vonn discussing quite openly depression. And these voices make a difference, and they can do so globally. I was reading a few days ago Melinda Gates' book called The Moment of Lift, and there was something quite profound in it. It's about empowering women. And it said that the way you lift humanity mm-hmm. is by empowering women. Mm-hmm. And we know that the Gates Foundation has put contraception as a key part of their strategy. But it's a striking result that dialogue around contraception can have to the success of humanity. Every dollar spent on family planning can save governments up to $6 mm-hmm. to improve health, housing, and sanitation. So I do think this will be a female forward world for biopharma. We have a great opportunity to help shape that.
Well, as some of you know, I worked at the Food and Drug Administration for many years. I'm going to be honest, I didn't see a lot of women's health conditions center. That doesn't mean none, but they were in the majority. And as you may know, the Office of Women's Health is in the commissioner's office, not in the center. And let's look at history. The history of the industry has not been investment in women's health. And I'd like to understand, you know, is that because there was lack of knowledge of the disease condition? Is it the perception that there's not a viable commercial market there? Why is it different today, Patrick, than it was 5 years ago? What has changed that now is going to make investment in women's health issues a priority, a commercial priority?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, John, that it's been far too long for there to be great advancements in women's health. With some notable distinctions, it's been a space that has not attracted a lot of attention from the industry. And I think the reasoning is complicated. There's a confluence of overlapping and difficult reasons. Even when I look at our heritage, how we created Mycovia, even investment groups have been historically male leadership. And we know for a long time that women have been underrepresented in clinical trials. The medical guidelines have not been to the level that should allow them to participate. And I think that combination of factors is creating this dearth of innovation. And we know that it leads to poor outcomes for women. There's an economic impact to that. And if you're thinking about a return of investment, the economics should matter. Even if we're not moved as we should be by the social impact, the economics will. We know that women, when they present, they oftentimes will have pre-existing medical conditions. And it results in a much greater consumption of healthcare dollars. And so we've taken that to heart when we're thinking about a chronic disease like recurrent vulvovaginal candidiasis, RVVC. These are when women have three or more yeast infections in a given year, it's debilitating. It can be very confining, limiting a woman's freedom of relationships. And it's quite pervasive. 138 million women around the globe suffer from it each year. And if economics matter, that results in $14 billion of lost productivity from this disease that for decades we haven't really innovated in. So if we want outcomes to change, the industry does need to prioritize more female-focused diseases.
Sabrina, what's the role of bias? Is there a societal bias against women's health issues?
You know, it's interesting. I think it's society's sometimes interpretation, right, of what those issues mean. So, you know, Lynn, actually everyone's touched on this a little bit, but the fact that for some of these conditions, they seem like a life-altering condition, not life-threatening condition, right? And so then there's a bias that maybe it's not as important. I think the other thing is that sometimes there's this bias around the fact that some of the, you know, larger maybe pharmaceutical companies or mid-sized companies don't appear to be investing in women's health. Sometimes despite the fact when they have very robust commercial franchises in the category in women's health, but because they're not investing in terms of their internal research programs, I think that can sometimes be misinterpreted, that there isn't an industry commitment to the category. We kind of feel it's actually the opposite. I think the model has grown up where that internal research dollars are often going towards conditions like right now, gene therapy, right? The things that are very much in vogue in terms of where research dollars are spent, but that doesn't change the fact that they aren't committed to the category. And as long as there are companies like ours on the panel today, all of our companies that are innovating in women's health or advancing that innovation to address those persistent unmet needs, those do represent commercial opportunities. And I would point to the fact that Bayer's a great example. Mirena, which is the only contraceptive to be over $1 billion product, and they're the only company that's built a contraceptive and over $1 billion product, they in-licensed that product. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the companies that are in the category, I think, know what women's health can represent commercially, but the model has been to license or acquire those products as opposed to investing directly in the development. So as long as others are doing that, which is what this panel is about today, we're all doing that, we will drive innovation forward. And I think that model is a little bit of a misconception for people because they're not accustomed to that model in other therapeutic categories.
So Lynn, why is the time now?
So the time is now, I think, because history, I think, waxes and wanes. And I want to, you mentioned sort of the past and where we've come from. I would say it's interesting. Women's health used to flourish. And you think back 30 years ago, it was flourishing. And the NIH was founded. It set forth new policies saying women need to be in clinical trials and in animal studies. The NIH hired its first female director. The Women's Health Initiative was booming, 150,000 women and $600 million of investment. And, you know, the pharmaceutical industry was very engaged in women's health. But unfortunately, when those results came out, it showed that millions of women were getting hormone replacement therapy that may be causing cardiovascular events and breast cancer. And it put a large pall and a shadow over women's health. And while we now know those results were much more complex than initially appreciated, it caused a lot of pharma to withdraw a little bit. And now I think we're, as sort of the others have alluded, we're starting to see more of a resurgence. As you said, we know women are out there. There are lots and lots of women suffering with lots of diseases, but we need to elevate their voices because people need to hear how much they're suffering. We need to get research funding because I think one of the biggest problems in this area is too little investment in research, which means scientists can't come into reproductive medicine because they can't get funded. There's no research, there's no innovation. If there's no innovation, there's nothing for the life sciences industry to latch onto and develop into new treatment. Yeah. And John, you mentioned the FDA, so I have to say, those companies are going to places where there's rapid development paths in a lot of science, oncology, rare diseases. And in women's health, we need to see very much the same thing. And then I think we can really start to get the type of innovation and transformation that we're all looking for.
It's a great point, and also getting more women in clinical trials across the disease spectrum. We haven't seen that up until some recent years where we've made a commitment. And Senya, what do you find are some of those trends? Is it more an issue of bias? Is it lack of knowledge? Is it just belief there's not commercial opportunity? What has been your experience?
Yeah, I think my experience is exactly what Lynn has alluded to. I think there was a big hit on the women's healthcare market and the perception after the Women Health Initiative study, which practically cut the hormone replacement therapy market size by half, which of course resulted in some of the big pharma companies starting to, I would say, limit the investment in this research, at least in the women's health, which created an opportunity for companies like us. That's what Preglam exactly did back in 2007. We realized that the big pharmas are pulling out. That's when you, as a small company, can actually make a difference, because you can never compete, even in the clinical trials, even in the investments for the clinical trials, if you're up to Pfizer, Bayer. But you can compete if you are up to different small startup companies who are usually VC-backed because they want to take a risk. And that's the way actually you can bring, and that's how we did. We brought a real innovation, which then once you've done the heavy lifting, once you've been through taking the risk and bringing a positive phase three, then the big pharmas become more interested, and they're actually willing to pay the price, because for them it's still probably more efficient to rely on outside development and innovation as opposed to bring it in the house, where maybe the strategic interest is no longer focused on the women's health, but more on, you know, rare diseases or the oncology. So in a way, yeah, it was, this Women Health Initiative was a kind of a negative news for women health market that I think we still today suffering a bit, but it created an opportunity for companies like ours for this panel.
And some of it is about awareness, as many of you have mentioned. So I'd like you each to have an opportunity to talk about how are you bringing women's health issues to the forefront, and even specifically what you're working on and what level of development it's in. And some of you have talked about that in your introduction, but really it's about how do we bring these issues to the forefront. And maybe we can start with Sabrina this time.
Sure. So as I mentioned in a couple times actually today on the panel, so as we think about innovation in women's health, our view is that it's not always about necessarily having to invent a new active pharmaceutical ingredient. Sometimes it's really about delivering the product in a way that makes sense for her, and that is a really great way often to enhance outcomes and convenience, which in the end is the goal, right? And so as we think about the therapeutic areas where we're focused, I would highlight three where there are persistent unmet needs for different reasons. The phase three program I mentioned is in bacterial vaginosis. that condition is a great example of one that people think of as a nuisance condition in terms of what the woman normally experiences. It's going to send her to the clinician's office, like preterm birth, infertility, so some very serious outcomes. And so the program we're taking forward is leveraging, frankly, delivering a known antibiotic, one that we know works well actually in bacterial vaginosis, but subpar overall cure rates, but delivers it in a way that has an opportunity to hopefully enhance the cure rates and enhance convenience. So it's a one-time delivery of clindamycin, so one and done. And clindamycin is one of the drugs that's already been approved in this condition, but the cure rates for the approved therapies are in the right now mid-30s to mid-60%. And this particular formulation saw a cure rate of 86% in the phase two investigator-initiated proof of concept study. So has an opportunity to be very impactful in the category with that convenience that can ensure that she's compliant and in a formulation that's designed to keep the drug resident so that the clindamycin can So that's our phase three program. I'll quickly mention two others that I think are worth highlighting. So Ovaprene is our once a month hormone-free contraception. So contraception is a category Patrick talked about that has had funding from the Gates Foundation. We have another program actually that's where we have funding from the Gates Foundation to support. The Ovaprene program was supported from the NIH. So our phase two study was paid for by the NIH, which was successful last year. And it's seen as an unmet need because in contraception, there aren't very effective hormone-free options. And a lot of women can't take hormones, they can't tolerate them or they're contraindicated. And there are also a lot of data supporting that a once a month contraceptive format for an on-demand method is really what women want. And so this is the first step for once a month hormone-free contraceptive that we're looking to start our phase three in, which is expected to report out in 22. And the last condition I want to highlight to make a different point, you know, talked about bacterial vaginosis, which is, you know, unmet need, persistent unmet need, and made that point around sort of life-altering, but very important in terms of outcomes that can happen. And then contraception, which seems like a category where we've had the pill since the 60s. Why do you need innovation? But there's always room for something that can really enhance outcomes and convenience for women. But the third one I want to talk about is female sexual arousal disorder, which touches on a lot of points we made today, which is female sexual arousal disorder is her version of erectile dysfunction. And it is just as distressing and frankly even more prevalent in women than erectile dysfunction in men, yet there was nothing approved to treat the condition. And so here we're looking, as I mentioned earlier, to take sildenafil, the active ingredient in Viagra, and instead of delivering it orally, oral Viagra, unfortunately, in women has a side effect profile that is not optimal for this condition. So instead of delivering it systemically, we're locally to the genital tissue on demand. So we're hoping to be, you know, the first taking something forward for a condition that is just as prevalent, if not more so in women and just as distressing, but has been overlooked until now. And it's a great example of not needing necessarily a new chemical entity to address the condition, but taking something that's known and understood and making it available for her.
Okay. So. And you mentioned Patrick. So I'm going to ask Patrick what he is doing and his organization is doing to bring these women's health issues to the forefront.
So we're focusing on recurrent vulvovaginal candidiasis. These are chronic yeast infections. And many will know yeast infections are a very typical part of life, but having them three or more times a year is unusual. And there is no real good treatment for that. The condition is associated not only with the physical symptoms, but some really distressing psychological and social effects. We have seen far too many very sad stories about the oppression, the isolation, the embarrassment, the powerlessness that comes with RVVC. And if we do believe that our future is based on empowering women, RVVC would be a real target for us. we know that the women can't live a normal life without it, with this condition. And so we're focusing on that 100%. We have a phase 3 study that is well underway. And just like I think Sabrina had mentioned with BV, even in the face of this global pandemic, we're very happy and thankful to both the sites and to patients who have continued on in this study. It puts us in a position that we'll have top line data on our phase 3 program at the end of this year. We do have a favorable interaction, John, with the FDA, with a qualified infectious disease product designation, which gives us a fast track route, which will bring forward our 48-week data for our part of our approval. And all goes well, we expect to be the first FDA-approved product for RVVCO on the market at the end of 2021. So that's captured all of our development attention. I would say from an empowerment and what we're doing to advance women's health, socially, our company takes a lot of interest in things that we can do outside of drug development, doing things like supporting Girls on the Run and other local efforts to promote women's health, promote women's well-being, because it's been silent for too long.
Good, that's good to hear. Senya, tell us what you're working on and how your organization is bringing women's issues to the forefront.
So we're working on, let's say, three areas. One is making sure that the portfolio that we have is actually addressing the widest range of women health issues, because we do deal with gynecologists. They are our customers and doctors who treat women. And they start seeing women when they're adolescent, with mainly issues are contraception or infections. Then they follow these young girls when they become women, when they become pregnant, when they become mothers. And they follow them all the way through to the menopause and even after the menopause. So what's important is to actually have a portfolio that is addressing every area or every part of their life where different conditions are affecting these women. So that's on one hand. On the other hand, we are very active on the social media, like what you said in the introduction. I mean, women go to the internet far more often than men. They really do their homework when they need to do, when it comes to understanding the condition that they have, the treatment options. And I think this is where we as a company can contribute, by making sure that adequate information is easily accessible, and also verified information is easily accessible, because I think that's also important. And on the third level, it's everything that is around political environment, or I would say the authorities. So what we are doing, we are working with the European Parliament group, which we're working with them to help them on issuing women health policies, and several policies that are almost a commitment from every European country to take seriously certain conditions related to women health, and then put resources, be it educational or other type of resources, in place, so that these conditions, or at least these issues, are properly discussed in each country and put on a priority list for the awareness and the education.
And Lynn, what about your organization? How are you bringing these issues to the forefront?
Well, first, I love what the other speakers have said, and I agree completely that it's going to take this cross-sector effort to really elevate the conversation. So as I said earlier, we're big into advocacy, mm-hmm. but we're focused on also, like others, bringing new medicines. And it's so gratifying to hear the broad range of diseases that need new medicines and that people are working on them. We're working on two different diseases. So these are what I call period diseases. They are enormously common, and yet next to nobody talks about them. So there are women suffering from heavy menstrual bleeding and pain from uterine fibroids, as well as very severe pain during their periods, women with endometriosis, as well as non-menstrual pelvic pain. And we have a vision to have one pill once a day that can bring symptomatic relief and give women an alternative, so they don't have to have the 350,000 hysterectomies that women undergo in just the US each year, as well as other invasive procedures, something that gives them an option. And now more than ever, I think in this COVID pandemic, women are looking for medical options where they can take maybe a medicine at home instead of going into the clinic. And just to shed a little light on these diseases, because again, I think it's people hear words, but they don't really know so much what they mean. And when you say uterine fibroids, these are benign tumors, which John, of course, you know, that grow in on the walls of the uterus. In many women, they're asymptomatic, but in a significant number, and we think about 3 million, and again, the US alone, these women suffer from heavy bleeding, bleeding so heavy that for 7 to 10 days a month, they can't go on about their normal business and their normal activities. And again, get anemic and fatigued and really markedly decreases their quality of life. And with endometriosis, it's a long name for disease that impacts 10% of women of reproductive age. And so it causes significant pain. It really is a systemic inflammatory disease where women, I mean, these are young women in their sort of their prime years, are spending on average 18 days a year in bed because of severe pain. And they undergo multiple procedures and operations seeking relief from this pain. And even in fact, are very concerned about infertility because it is a leading cause of infertility in these women. So we're hoping to get approval for a new medicine. We've got a new drug application for these women with heavy menstrual bleeding and uterine fibroids that will be submitted any day now. And with endometriosis, we have one positive trial. We need one more. So hopefully new treatments for all of these diseases that we're talking about are on the way.
All right. Well, let's have some fun in our last few minutes. And let's pretend I'm skeptical and jaded. I told you I worked at FDA. So that's not too far of a jump. And you want me to invest in your women's health product or to be a partner with you on a women's health issue. And we did give warning to everyone ahead of time, just so listeners know. Give me your 1 minute pitch. I'm going to get out my timer, your 1 minute elevator pitch to get me to invest or partner with you. I kind of feel like Patrick George this far. We'll do him last since he's probably particularly good. He's heard it all. Let's start with Zenya.
Okay. So, what I would say is like 50% of the population are women. A majority of health family decisions are led by women. Women health is a significant market, as we've seen in the history, and we've seen that it suffered from some of the clinical data. Nevertheless, we've seen with many companies, small companies, who have actually used this situation as an opportunity to go out and look for innovative products and bring really solutions that resulted in very successful commercial products. This area is for sure on a positive trend to further even develop. And what I would say is that from the investment world, there are more and more women who become an investor. And we see there a trend, and that will probably have an effect on how the investment world sees women health as an area, because they need a bit of the education.
Okay, I liked it. Lynn, let's go to you.
And I echo Ksenia. 50% of the population are women. Millions of women are suffering from diseases that are inadequately treated. There is a tremendous opportunity here to help those women move forward to achieve their full potential. And we know when women achieve their full potential, they bring the entire community and family along with them. They are the chief medical officers or the officers of their own individual families, making decisions. They incur more healthcare expenses than men do, and they lead the way on healthcare spending. So let's address their needs, let's listen to them, and there is no question there is a huge untapped market here.
just in time, we got there. And Sabrina.
So I'm going to take a little different spin. So Lynn and Sonia did a great job, I think, talking about the demographics. I'll take it from a business perspective, which is women's health is one of the few, if not the only right now that I can think of, category where you can actually have a first line or a first in category product opportunity using known chemical entities that are well understood and well known, so often using that 505(b)(2) regulatory pathway, but leveraging the female's unique biology, so where you can really make products easier and better and often more effective or a better side effect profile for her to utilize and address these first in category unmet needs. And leveraging a very well-known biology and therefore often increasing your time to market and decreasing your cost to get there and risk. And it's a category, as we've talked about, where you also don't necessarily have to take on the burden of building out that commercial infrastructure. The companies that already have it in the space are looking to bring products in, right? Because they're not investing internally in R&D, so they are licensing and acquiring. And we didn't get to talk about our partnership with Bayer on Ovaprene, but it's a great example of that, where they are committed to the space and are looking for new innovation to bring in. So if you build it, they will come.
It's like a ballpark. But not during COVID.
But better for women. Right.
Now, Patrick, you actually have listened to pitches in your career. So what's your 1 minute pitch to get people to invest or become your partner?
I'd first endorse wholly what my colleagues have said on the panel. And I think about, just like we all do, about an investment is the prospect of having a return on it. And when you think about the fact that 75% of healthcare dollars is spent in areas of chronic health, and that that women tend to consume more of that over the long term, then it just stands to reason that we need to address women and their chronic health needs. And that aperture can be expanded beyond even the topics that we've been speaking about today. Could to issues that affect both men and women, but maybe affect them in different ways. Heart disease, diabetes, depression, Alzheimer's, all are part of women's health, though maybe in the untraditional way. Equally so, still vitally important and a great opportunity for us to have a return on investment where there's been such a lack of innovation of late. That women's health, I believe, should be a shining example of what the future of biopharma can be.
Well, we're just about out of time. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more question real fast for you all to answer. Labeling it women's health, positive, negative, or neutral? Real quick, let's go around the grid. We'll start with Patrick. You're eliminating almost half of the population, good, neutral, or bad?
Yeah, I think it depends on the context. There are some diseases that are going to be exclusively or predominantly focused on women. And in that regard, we do need to have a dedicated focus on women's health. But there's a whole litany of conditions, some of which I just mentioned, that occurs both in men and women. Mm-hmm. And just pigeonholing some of these maladies as a women's health concern, I think misses some of the broader physiological impact that we'll see in some of the more chronic conditions.
Lynn, good, neutral, or bad?
I think it's good because I see it as an umbrella term, exactly as Patrick said. Yes, diseases exclusive for women, but yes, also to diseases that disproportionately impact women, and yes, also for women diseases where women present differently because of their physiology than men. So all three of those are in women's health and need to be addressed.
Sonia, is it neutral?
No, it's positive. Actually, I agree completely with Lynn and Patrick, and I think it requires also from some of the physicians that difference, and also maybe it forces them to specialize a little bit more because they need to understand that they have to look woman as a woman and sometimes differentiate between women and just, you know, human condition.
And Sabrina, is that a mindset? Is that a mindset change? Is that something that you wouldn't have said positive 5 years ago?
You know, it's interesting because I think I wouldn't have said it was positive maybe 5 years ago, which ironically is when I started the company, seeing that there was an opportunity because people weren't looking at it as positively. But I do think it's positive now. And it really, or I would spin it a tiny bit as healthcare for women, either conditions that primarily affect women or conditions that solely affect women or conditions where, you know, you can use vaginal drug delivery and deliver them in a way to her that's unique. But I think it is positive now because we're aware as a society of the needs that exist. More so, we're talking about them. We're using words that we wouldn't have used on a bio panel before, like vagina. And they're okay because these are real conditions and these are real healthcare issues.
Well, I want to thank you all for redefining biopharma in the first place in a female forward world. And I want to thank you for joining me in this very interesting and vigorous discussion about the future of biopharma, especially as it relates to women's health issues. I think that's